This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's a moment in the conversation you're about to hear where I do a double take. It's the moment where Carl Hart says he believes the only way to truly transform the opioid addiction crisis, the only way to utterly transform how we think about it, is to completely legalize all drugs. Not just decriminalize, fully legalize. Hart is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia University. He's been researching drug use for decades, an effort he writes about in his book, High Price, a neuroscientist's journey of self-discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. And he says that the majority of drug users, some 70%, are not addicts. So he believes a better policy approach would be to legalize drugs and then focus on the smaller number of people who are addicted by treating their underlying causes of drug use. Carl Hart will be speaking tomorrow at a Boston public forum. It's sponsored by William James College, and it's called Opioid Crisis: Thinking Outside the Box. And when we spoke earlier today, we began with Hart's own history with drugs, growing up in a rough neighborhood in Miami in the 1970s.
When I was coming up, we thought that crack cocaine addiction was destroying communities, particularly black communities. And as a result, we implemented policies. We said that crack cocaine was causing all of these high rates of unemployment. But the highest rates of unemployment in the United States was 1982. Crack cocaine did not appear until late 1984, 1985. And so we missed the mark with our sort of hysteria. But I thought that crack was destroying the black community. Mm-hmm. And so that led me to study crack cocaine and other drugs. And in my sort of study of these drugs, I had that in my mind. But then along the way, I discovered that, well, crack wasn't the real problem. There were other issues.
So if the problem isn't the drug itself, tell me in more detail what the problem is.
The problem isn't the drug itself. And we know this because 75% or more, nearly 80% of the people who use these drugs don't become addicted. Just a small percentage, 20% or so, which is important. I don't want to downplay that. But it tells you that, wait a second, everybody who uses this drug does not become addicted. So therefore, we have to look at those folks who are becoming addicted, and maybe that can tell us something about what's going on with those people. What we know about the opioids is that the people who are more likely to become addicted are young white males who are unemployed in rural areas. Mm-hmm. Now, that tells you something. It's like, well, maybe these folks, we need to make sure they have job trainings, make sure they have jobs, make sure they have opportunities. That will go a long way in solving some of the problems related to addiction. Of course, that won't solve all the addiction, but you're now starting to focus your treatment more specifically towards the people's actual needs.
Forgive me for saying this, but my brain kind of keeps stopping at this number that you've put out about that it's roughly 20% of people who become addicted. Are we saying that the other, 70 or 80% are that they're casual users and that these drugs aren't having a negative impact on their life?
Sure. That's precisely what we're saying. Let's think about the last three occupants of the White House. Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama, all those guys used illicit drugs during their youth or when they were young men. They were casual users. In fact, they went on to hold the highest office in the land. In my story, in High Price, my book, I describe my own drug use. There are a number of people who use drugs where they don't have problematic drug use. This is not an endorsement for young people to go out and use drugs. This is just a fact. And if you know that fact, it helps you to focus your attention where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. The number feels so much higher than 20%, right? I mean, is that because of the way we're talking about it now as a society or what?
Yes, the number feels so much more than 20% because of the way we're talking about it. Let's look at this fact. Let's check this out. We're concerned in Massachusetts specifically about opioids. When you look at the numbers of people who actually use opioids in the United States, let's just look at the number of people who've used heroin in the past 30 days. It's under 500,000. It's about 430,000 people. Now, when you compare that to something like marijuana, for marijuana, that number is 22 million. And then if you compare it to something like cocaine, that number is nearly 2 million. And then if you compare it to something like methamphetamine, that number is nearly 600,000. You can see all of those drugs, they're are used far more than heroin. But if you pick up your newspapers today, you will think that heroin numbers are off the chart. Now, the number of users of heroin has increased. That's a fact. But we have to keep it in perspective and understand that when we think about it in relative terms, the number of people who use heroin, it's always lower than those other drugs that I name. Mm. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned, because we should be. But we should focus on what the real concerns are. When we think about a drug like heroin, the real concerns are things like drug overdose death. I'm concerned about that. And now when we look at drug overdose death, you learn that about 75% of the people who die from a heroin-related overdose death or any other opioid-related death do so because they combine it with another sedative, like alcohol, like a benzodiazepine. Given that that's the case, our newspaper articles, our public education message should be simple. If you're going to use heroin or another opioid, do not combine it with another sedative like alcohol or benzodiazepine.
But what about all those people who use heroin that they don't even know what exactly is in it? I mean, because we've had a lot of cases where overdoses happen because of, you know, the heroin is laced with fentanyl, but there's no way of knowing until you've actually ingested it or taken the drug.
That's a real concern. When we think about heroin laced, fentanyl is another opioid that is about 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin itself. So we have to ask the question, on the one hand, why would dealers lace their heroin with something more potent and not tell the user and charge them more? That's another issue. We can get to that issue later. But the point here is that if police forces and public health officials recognize that local heroin is tainted with fentanyl, why not put out public health messages, warnings to the local community, this particular brand of heroin is laced with fentanyl. In that way, the people in the local community are much more likely to be aware that the heroin is laced with fentanyl.
Right. I think, in fact, we are starting to see some of that. I mean, it wasn't that long ago where there was a rash of terrible overdoses in and around the Holyoke area, and police did exactly what you were talking about. They put out messages on social media saying there's a terrible batch out there right now. Don't take it.
I commend those police, that police force, but it doesn't happen enough, and I think that we should take the lead of that police organization.
Part of what you've been advocating recently vis-a-vis drug policy, and much of what you've said so far sort of leads to this, is that you believe, do I have this right, that all of these substances should be decriminalized?
Yeah, in my book, High Price, I argued that these substances should be decriminalized. And I was making that argument based on what had happened in places like Portugal and the Czech Republic. Portugal decriminalized all drugs, including heroin, since 2001, and the Czech Republic in the late 1990s. And they're doing better than us on all of the major drug-related indications. I have modified my positions because I am concerned about adulterants. Decriminalization simply treats drug possession violations like traffic violation. Whereas decriminalization makes sure people do not go to jail, it does nothing about the adulterants that are in the drugs on the streets. And that's one of my major concerns these days, related to the heroin being tainted with fentanyl and those sorts of things. Mm. And so as a result, I am now arguing that we need to have legal drug regulation such that the state makes sure that we have quality control of these substances.
Okay, so I want to be sure I just heard you right. So full-blown legalization then.
That's right, but I don't say full-blown legalization. When we say full-blown legalization about alcohol or we say full-blown legalization about tobacco, we don't say that. We regulate those. I mean, alcohol, before it comes on the market, it has to have, make sure it has quality control, governmental approval, and all those sorts of things. That's what I'm advocating.
Okay, so this leads me to a question I really want to ask you. We already have legalization and regulation of prescription painkillers, prescription opioid painkillers. And many people we've talked to over the past several years have said that in part, not exclusively, but in part, the spike that we're seeing in opioid addiction is coming from legal, regulated prescription drugs. So, I mean, if that's all already happening, don't we have a perfect case study in how even like legalizing and regulating doesn't solve a problem? People say it's helped further the opioid addiction crisis.
Wait, you said quite a bit there. Now, when you say legal regulation, it's like you cannot get opioids unless you have a physician, unless you have some medical condition that indicates that you will get prescription opioid. And then recently, with our concerns about the prescription opioids and heroin, we have become more even more restrictive in the availability of these drugs. So I think we need to be clear about precisely what we're saying.
Okay, well, I guess what I'm saying is that we have spoken to many people who say it's not that they were addicted to heroin or they're not, the epidemic isn't because of heroin, but it's because of exactly what you said, that people get a prescription for some medical need for an opioid-based painkiller, and then they become addicted to that. And that's what then leads to their heroin use.
Yes. Okay, that certainly happens. But I don't know if that's related to what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that adults will be allowed to get what they want, just like they are allowed to get alcohol. That's not exactly the same as someone having prescription, then they're being cut off. Now, whenever you have drugs that are available, you have to make sure that your education surrounding those drugs is also sufficient and appropriate. And oftentimes when we think about education as it relates to prescription opioid, it has been insufficient and inadequate. So let's think about some of the prescription opioids, Vicodin, Percocets. Those are some popular ones. They also contained large doses of acetaminophen, mm-hmm. ranging anywhere from 325 milligrams to 650 milligrams of acetaminophen, and only about 5 to 10 milligrams of the opioid. Now, one of the things that people do, and they get in trouble with this, is that they take several of these pills. Acetaminophen is the number one reason in the world for liver toxicity. That means that people have to be educated about acetaminophen toxicity. They need to be educated about combining these drugs with other sedatives. And we haven't, because we have been so busy waving the flag of hysteria related to the numbers of people who are using these drugs, as opposed to making sure that we keep people safe.
Yeah. You know, I think we're starting to see an awareness of the importance of education here in a number of ways in Massachusetts. We just had a bill that was signed into law that, you know, tries to limit the amount of painkillers that a doctor can prescribe. It's got some other features in it. People are talking about you know, greater outreach. In Gloucester, we've got a police department there that's really been
backwards.
They've been in a way in the forefront, because they told people struggling with heroin addiction, come to us and we won't arrest you. We'll help get you into treatment instead.
Yeah, see, that's ignorance parading as compassion.
Really?
I mean, this is
Why?
My major concern. Let me explain. As we talked about at the beginning of this interview, the vast majority of people who use these drugs are not addicted. We say things like, well, we're not going to incarcerate these people because that sounds compassionate. Instead, we're going to give them treatment. If they don't need treatment nor incarceration, what are you talking about?
Well,
the vast majority
don't. I suppose
don't.
The people who are coming, who take the Gloucester police up on their offer, are people who feel like they need treatment. But it's sort of...
Or they can turn themselves in because they know that they may have been caught and they might be turned in. And so therefore they say, I'm going to take treatment in lieu of prison. That's an easy sort of decision.
Hmm. Well, give me some other examples of where you think education can and should be happening.
Well, you know, as you talked about what's happening in Massachusetts and some of these sort of progressive things, the first thing you led with was that we are going to restrict access. That's the thing that the bill says, mm-hmm. restricting the amount of access. That's not where one starts. That means that people who actually need these medications are going to have a difficult time getting them. There have been numbers of studies, plethora of studies now, that have shown that if you are Black and you go to an ER or you go to your physician, the likelihood of you receiving a pain, opioid-based pain medication is considerably lower than your white counterpart. So it functions as another way, another tool to use for racial discrimination. And we know that. And then we think about particularly when we start thinking about who's being arrested for heroin trafficking these days. We're talking about black and brown people. That's my concern. I'm concerned that as we continue with our hysteria, it functions as another tool to further marginalize people who are marginalized.
Right. Well, I want to talk more about that, actually, because I think it's an exceedingly important point because, you know, we have now, from President Obama on down, at least the beginnings of a conversation about how our criminal justice system has been, you know, in their view, largely perverted by the drug war because it's put so many young minority men specifically in jail for long periods of time. So it seems to me as if your call for legalization would do a great deal to change that impact, would it not?
Yes, I did not say. Every Friday night, I teach a course in Sing Sing in New York City, one of the maximum security prisons here in the state. And so I have a firsthand look of what has happened with the war on drugs. Not only that, but I even have a kid who was arrested for drugs. And so I know this issue inside out. And when I hear the president, I hear these people who are seen as being compassionate, talking about treatment, they're not really dealing with the real issue. It allows us to continue to put money into law enforcement to arrest people for trafficking. Whereas when the users are seen as having a white face, we can be compassionate with them and then treat the dealers or the traffickers or the perceived traffickers differently.
Hmm. Well, Professor Hart, there's so much to discuss here, but we're unfortunately not going to be able to get to all of it. I did want to ask you one final question before we wrap up. You've presented us with some profound and, to be perfectly honest, challenging ideas here. And I can imagine that there are a lot of people listening who are feeling right now, yes, we have to change the way we educate people about these drugs, about their impacts, their effects. We have to change the criminal justice system. Perhaps we even need to decriminalize them. But when they hear you advocate legalization, for them, that's just a step too far. That, for them, is society giving its stamp of approval for something they can't approve of because maybe they know someone whose life has been profoundly altered or even ended because of these drugs. So what do you tell them?
I lost a loved one as well, and they said it was a heroin-related overdose death, and they said it was heroin overdose. But when I checked out the facts, it was mainly because this person combined heroin with alcohol, considerable amount of alcohol, and was not educated in order to protect herself. And so when I hear people say that, they're just misinformed. And I'm trying to make sure that we have a public discourse that is informed by evidence. And if we allow people to make these decisions based on some anecdotal emotional appeal, then we can expect the same results we've always had. I mean, if I've studied these drugs for 25 years, I have seen this issue inside out. And if people don't want to take my recommendation based on some emotional appeal, well, that's up to them. That's up to the society, and the society will have to pay the price for that ignorance.
Well, Carl Hart is a professor of psychology at Columbia University and director of the Residential Studies and Methamphetamine Research Laboratories at the New York Psychiatric Institute. He's also author of High Price, a neuroscientist's journey of self-discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. He'll be one of the keynote speakers at a conference on the opioid crisis that's being held by William James College tomorrow. We've got more information about that at radioboston.org. Professor Hart, thank you so very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, consider this. Nearly 1,200 Massachusetts residents died in connection with opioid use in 2014. So do you think Carl Hart's idea of legalization would have done anything to help them? Or perhaps would it make the opioid addiction crisis even worse? Let us know what you think about this conversation. Go to radioboston.org and send us a comment, or you can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.